Welcome to the NSPCC Learning Podcast, where we share learning and expertise in child protection from inside and outside of the organisation. We aim to create debate, encourage reflection, and share good practice on how we can all work together to keep babies, children, and young people safe.
Hi, and welcome to the latest NSPCC Learning Podcast. Back in January 2020, we published a series of podcasts on harmful sexual behaviour, also referred to as HSB. To date, these have been amongst our most well-received episodes, and so we've recorded three new podcasts on HSB. The first in the series focuses on the underlying principles of direct work with children and young people who've displayed HSB. Katie Tomkinson and Rowan Wolfe are social workers and children's practitioners at our Stoke Service Centre, who both have years of experience working on HSB services and with children and young people, which they discuss in this episode. This episode was recorded in March 2021, and Katie and Rowan have pitched the conversation for those that are maybe newer to HSB work, but offer really good tips, advice and information which we hope you find interesting and helpful, regardless of experience.
Rowan, when you meet a child for the first time and you're going to be completing a piece of work with them around harmful sexual behaviour, what do you think is really important?
So I think the first thing is that the children who come and see us often are feeling really scared and really worried. They don't know what it's going to be like. They don't know if it's going to be like a police interview. A few have said like they expected us to almost put a spotlight on them and interrogate them, and I think that's quite scary, where actually we take a much more trauma-informed and therapeutic approach to our work. That doesn't mean that we don't challenge, it doesn't mean that we don't say the difficult things, but we always come from a nurturing perspective when we do that.
Yeah, I always say to children when I first meet them, you know, you're not in any trouble with me, and you will never be in any trouble with me. My job is to keep you safe and keep everybody else safe. So it's that kind of thing.
Yeah. And I think with that, we're always transparent that, you know, there is sort of caveats to what stays private between us and then what actually would have to get passed on. So, you know, if it's a child who's on an order, there might be a situation where there is a consequence if they share information with you or they don't comply with an order. And, you know, that doesn't mean that you can't do that in a sensitive way. So again, it's just trying to always keep that nurturing approach to it, even though there might be sort of quite serious consequences, or if they told you that they'd done further behaviour and that had to be passed on for a safeguarding concern.
Yeah, so I suppose it's really helpful to think about explaining to them safeguarding and confidentiality and its kind of limitations right from the get-go.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we've always said, like, you need to be really clear on what the behaviour is, why they're coming to see you, because sometimes they've seen lots of different professionals in their lives, especially if they've had experience of abuse or sort of neglect and different sorts of trauma. And you need to be clear that you're there to work around the harmful sexual behaviour and name it, because often that, just saying it in the first place, is the thing that makes them sort of more relaxed, because they're worried about what it will be like. So if you get that out of the way at the beginning, you've laid it on the table, haven't you? You've said, why are you there? And then you can move on.
Yeah, and I sometimes, exactly that, tell them why we're there and the piece of work that we're going to be doing and what that might look like, but also give them that reassurance, like, but we're not going to talk about that more today. So it's that kind of containment around that message as well, so that initially they're not thinking exactly like you said, a police interview.
Yeah, and I've got like areas of work cards, so things like harmful sexual behaviour, worries, fears, feelings, school, you know, the sort of usual topics that we cover. And then I might lay them out and say, these are the sorts of things we're going to talk about, because it's that fear of the unknown that's like quite scary. But then I'll say, just on the first sort of session, would you like to choose which topic we do first? So they've got a bit of control and ownership over it. I don't let them do that forever, because obviously sometimes you then never move on in your work, because they'll stay with things that they feel most comfortable with.
Yeah, I tend to give them a bit of a warning as we're moving through the assessment that we're going to start to think more about the specific harmful sexual behaviour that brought them to the service. And I might say, are we going to talk about that next week or the week after? And give them like that very limited choice. So there's some sense of empowerment, but like you say, not complete control over the sessions, because often children won't want to bring it at all.
Yeah. And I think probably the most important thing is that therapeutic relationship we have with them, and developing trust and allowing them to feel safe so that they feel that you're somebody that they can open up to, because they're ultimately going to be asked to talk about some of their darkest feelings. And if any one of us was asked to share our sexual experiences with another person, we'd be mortified.
Yeah.
And we would just be cringing, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
And then not only are we asking them to talk about their sexual experiences, they're still only children. And also that sexual experience has been one that's been harmful, and they've got in trouble with someone for it. And potentially they may have no longer be allowed to live with their family. There could be all sorts of implications for them. So you need to make them feel really safe, so that they do feel that they can kind of open up and talk about those things.
Yeah, and I guess that also that unconditional positive regard that we would have. So it's really, really bigging them up, probably more so than you think feels natural sometimes.
Yeah.
Because you can't say enough positives, can you, to really build that relationship and let them know that, you know, their identity is not the harmful sexual behaviour. That's one part of one thing that they did, and it's certainly not all of them, and remind them of all the strengths and skills and lovely qualities that they have.
Yeah, and one of the biggest things that when you're doing sort of any AIM assessment or anything like that is you're looking for those strengths. You're looking at how you can build on them, and you need to be demonstrating that in your work all along, that you value them, that you can see all the things that they're good at, so that they're getting that constant reinforcement that you're trying to build on their strengths, because you're also going to be identifying lots of things that they've done that have been harmful. So if you haven't got that contrast, it can just feel sort of quite punitive and shaming of them.
Yeah, and I guess then when children feel overwhelmed by shame, they'll quite often revert to a position of like absolute denial. They can't go anywhere near the behaviour to think about it in a way. So I think overcoming that, those feelings of shame, and kind of having those very gentle conversations with them, and like you say, naming it from the beginning, perhaps naming it in a way of, oh, I we know that this happened and that some people are worried about it, rather than kind of asking them about it. But it's doing it in that very sort of gentle way and reinforcing that most sessions. How many sessions would you have with a child or young person before you sort of directly address the harmful sexual behaviour in order to build up that therapeutic relationship?
It really varies. I mean, I've occasionally had a child that would choose like harmful sexual behaviour as their first topic because they're so terrified, they just want it out of the way. But that's few and far between. Generally, it's like the last thing they want to talk about.
Yeah.
But also we'd thread it through, I think. So every session there'll be a small mention of it, even though we're not going into any depth. I don't know, 5 or 6 sessions in, maybe we're starting to talk about it. It depends if I feel that I have built that rapport with them where they're ready to get to that point. And it might depend as well how open parents are, because some parents will talk from the outset quite openly in front of the child, and then that allows that a lot of that word, those words have been said before with them, so it's not as sort of scary.
Yeah.
Can you remember back to like the first session you ever did in harmful sexual behaviour?
Yeah, I remember.
And how you felt?
I remember meeting the first young person I worked with, and I came to the NSPCC as a student, so I was doing a home visit with my practice educator, so I was being assessed as well, which obviously massively added to my nerves. And the young person that we'd gone to meet wouldn't come downstairs. And I was absolutely terrified, you know, fundamentally that was what was going on for him. He was really scared that he was in trouble. He was, like you say, going to get shouted at, or all sorts of things. And he had been interviewed by the police, so it will have felt like a very scary experience. And what I did in that instance, and it's not the last time that I've ever done it, is I sat at the bottom of the stairs and said, I'm not going to come up. I'm just going to sit here. And the young person was in their bedroom, and I just started off really gradually. Do you think you could just open your bedroom door and we could say hi? Do you think you could talk to the landing so that I can see you? And then had like a bit more of a chat. And then bit by bit, you know, he was able to come down the stairs and felt reassured that he wasn't in trouble. And it was really about us building a relationship and working together. But I think it's allowing that time. If you think, I'm just going to do a quick home visit to meet this young person for the first time and I've got like 20 minutes at the end of the day, it's just potentially not going to be enough, is it, for that child?
Not at all.
Can you remember any experiences like that of children that have been really frightened?
Yeah, I mean, you get ones where they run off. You're then thinking about whether they're safe. I think the ones I find the most difficult is where the hood's up, it's down, they don't want to talk to you. They might have turned their chair. And although they're physically in the room, especially if they're on an order and they've kind of been told they've got to come, but they've got no intention of engaging with you. Mm. And you're trying to slowly break down those barriers to get them to talk, whilst also being aware that there's a time scale for you getting your assessment done and getting the information. And although we need information from young people, there's also lots of other sources for that information. So, you know, you can go and do file reads, you can talk to the professionals, talk to the family. So it doesn't mean that you can't do anything. But I think it's quite scary when you're sitting there, especially when you're new to it, and then you just can't even get them to engage at all. And you kind of feel like it's partly you have to just use your personality. You know, it might be that you just try and find out things about what they enjoy, and you're trying to find any way in where you can just get a little bit of that hood to come away from their faces slightly. And you think, right, okay, I'm in. I've got a little bit.
Yeah.
And you have to take it slowly. And the majority of the kids we work with get there eventually.
Yeah.
Occasionally and, not, but the majority do.
I would say so. And I would say quite quickly.
Yeah.
Like a home visit in a couple of sessions. But I think it's really interesting talking about the hood up, because what I've seen, you know, when I've met children at home is parents sort of saying, take your hood down, you need to look at them, da-da-da. And actually it goes to kind of... it's the opposite of what I would do, because I think children have their hood up and covering their face because they're scared, and that
it's
feels
protecting
safe
them.
And what we don't want to do is expose them when they're not ready to be exposed. So it's about letting them do that in their own time and not challenging that. And eye contact is a really interesting one, because I think there's so much research about kind of it's really positive that people are making eye contact with you, etc., etc. But actually we know if you're trying to talk about really difficult things,
It's so hard
with eye contact. Social worker said to me that children told them everything when they were driving in a car.
Yeah.
And I really believe that's because they're not looking at them directly. And I will sometimes use that as a tip. I'll even name it really clearly with the young person. I'll go, I'm going to ask you something really tricky. But actually, you know, it's really hard for you to look at me. So I'm just going to turn away. And it's done in a really sort of lighthearted way, in a kind of fun way. But it's really naming that I know this is difficult and I know I can make it a little bit easier. So we don't need to have that kind of sense of the child needs to be sat and they need to be sat still and they need to have their hood down and they need to be respectful and they need to be making eye contact, because I think none of those things are very sort of conducive to that therapeutic relationship, which, like you say, is the key, really.
And sometimes doodling or playing with a stress ball or fiddling or letting them walk around the room, that can be seen as, you know, they should be sitting there and behaving because they've done something wrong. And then actually that's just the wrong approach, because they're then not comfortable and they're not opening up. You're better off taking a much more therapeutic approach and allowing them to feel safe, because you're going to get a lot more out of them and it will be less likely they'll sort of display further behaviours. When we've talked a little about some of the behaviours that can be challenging to you as a practitioner when you're working with a child who's withdrawn or scared or refusing, could be angry, it could be they're denying. What sort of boundaries do you put around sessions to kind of make that a safe space?
So I think you've got to think about your practical issues. You've got to make sure that you've got, generally speaking, where possible, a consistent room that's where you're not being interrupted. I once did a piece of work in a school, and for whatever reason, we were put in the room with the photocopier. And even though they knew why we were there, about 3 or 4 times, member of staff keep coming in.
And they say, sorry when they come in.
Sorry.
No, carry on, sorry.
And you're thinking, I'm not going to be able to do any meaningful. And how is a child ever going to feel like they're going to explore something? And I don't know if you've experienced this, but sometimes when a child starts to talk, it almost feels like a bit of a spell. And I almost daren't breathe because I just want to let it flow without kind of breaking the spell.
Yeah.
So what you absolutely need is that really contained, safe space. And trying to secure rooms, I know, is tricky, but I think it is really important. So I think that's...
especially at the moment where we're working virtually a lot.
Yeah.
So that's even more challenging, because it's hard when you're working with children you've known for quite a long time and then you're working virtually. But when it's a child you've never met before... and you're doing a lot of that work virtually, it becomes even more of a barrier. But again, you can still make it work.
You can. And it's setting your stall out at the beginning and explaining to the child, the young person, their family, whoever they're living with, why that safe space is important and why it's not helpful to have interruptions or noises outside that are distracting. And we all live in the real world, so it's about doing our best with what you've got, I guess, but remembering why it's important.
What do you do about, like, some young people we work with might have a lot going on in their life, so every week there might be a crisis or they come in a certain mood. How do you deal with that? Do you go with whatever crisis it is, or do you try and get your session done?
I think it's predominantly you want the work to be child-led. There's no point, you know, trying to kind of metaphorically drag a child through a session because that's what you've planned, that's the work that you've planned to do, and because you've got timescales that you need to meet to complete whatever piece of work you're doing. Because it's not going to be meaningful to them, so it is pointless. So we know that a lot of the children that we work with have got a lot of other stuff going on for them, and they might be bringing that day. And sometimes what they need is just to be able to explore what's meaningful and real to them today. And you need to just put your session plan to one side altogether and go with it. But you've also got to balance that against sometimes in an avoidance strategy about why they're there, they'll be bringing something every week. And so I've used strategies like a car park. So we'll have kind of like an A4 piece of paper, and you're like, this is your car park, and these, and then we talk about the issues and we put them on our car park, and we're like, we're just going to park them for today. But I give that space to begin with to name them.
Do you sometimes say, we'll discuss it again at the end, so that you make sure that you've acknowledged it again before they leave, or how you're going to resolve that if it's appropriate?
Or just allow them a little bit of space to talk every session, or so we can talk about that next time. It really does depend what it is, because sometimes children are bouncing from crises to crises. And then I think the question you've got to ask yourself for those children is, what else do we need to do to secure their safety? You might be able to do an assessment of that young person, but whether or not you're going to be able to do any meaningful intervention work is questionable, I would say, because they need that safe and stable base to engage in any work. So it's like if you were an adult and you wanted to do some therapeutic work about your experiences of your parents divorcing when you were a child that was really difficult for you, and you were going through a divorce yourself, probably not the best time to do it. And we expect that and understand that for adults, but actually we put expectations on children that despite everything that's going on for you, we're still going to ask you to come and talk about some of the most difficult experiences, or communicate, not necessarily talk, about some of the most difficult experiences you've ever had. So I think as professionals, we need to be better at advocating for children where they're not in a position to do that work through no fault of their own. So I think that's also really important that we lead on that as professionals. And I think it's helpful to have some strategies around emotional regulation, so some grounding techniques. So it might be about asking them to think about the senses, you know, just name something you can see, name something that you can smell, name something that you can hear, just to kind of bring them back into the room if they're becoming really sort of emotionally uncontained.
Making sure they've got both feet on the floor, what can they feel through those feet, so that you ground, sort of physically grounds them as well.
Yeah. Or there's good ones about, especially sort of for younger children around, or older children actually, I think whoever it works for, it doesn't matter, around using breathing but in a sort of more fun way, so it doesn't feel like you're like, just breathe, which might sound a little bit patronising. So you could talk about kind of a bowl of their favourite hot food that they kind of hold up to their face, and they take a deep breath in through their nose to smell that beautiful food, but then it's too hot to eat, so you need to blow on it to cool it down. So those are quite like useful techniques just to have in your toolkit to bring if you can see that a child's becoming a little bit uncontained.
I had one where it was from a children's yoga thing I saw, where you get them to pretend to blow up a hot air balloon. And then they have to imagine that they're holding that hot air balloon. So they have their arms out like really, really wide. And then they're rocking to try and keep hold of that balloon. But actually what you're doing is mimicking those very early soothing techniques of rocking the body from side to side, which helps to regulate them. But when it's more for a little, sort of younger children, but also it can make them giggle because they're trying to keep hold of it. And then you can make that kind of more visual with them.
Yeah. And you might have to think of some different ones, because like you say, that might work great with one child, but if you've got, you know, a fairly grumpy 16-year-old, they might think, I'm not going to be holding any kind of hot air balloon, thanks very much. So it's about having skills and strategies that's going to work best with them and who they are.
I think some crises as well can almost be like sort of learning points, either for you for your assessment or for them. Yeah. So we'll often get young people, particularly with online behaviours, where they'll come to a session and a parent or a carer might say, "You'll never guess what they've done." And then they'll give you an sort of an example of something they've done online. They've chatted to someone they shouldn't. And although it's not great that they've done that and that's worrying, actually it's a really tangible way of having a conversation with them about something that's happened, where you can explain to them why. And it's in the moment, it's real for them. Because often when we get them for harmful sexual behaviour, they've been through a whole court process or a safeguarding child protection process. And then that means you might be getting them quite a few months after that behaviour's occurred. And then we get lots of, "I don't remember." Because who would want to remember? But it's easier sometimes. So actually they can be invaluable when those sort of crises do happen.
Yeah, I think some of the best sessions I've had have been ones that were completely unplanned, because it's about what the child's bought. And they're so in the moment that what they're able to communicate and articulate is kind of more in depth than they would be able to bring about things that happened ages ago. So in terms of top tips and sort of strategies and things, do you have anything else that you think is really helpful?
I think because it's harmful sexual behaviour, I think the reality is it is shocking, it is upsetting. So we as practitioners need to think about how we're going to respond when they start to tell us some of that detail. So if you look at a child like you're disgusted by what they've done or disgusted by them, then they're not going to want to open up to you. So even when what they're talking about is really upsetting, especially if it's, say, sibling abuse, I think I sometimes, when I've met the sibling and I might have a face that I'm putting to that behaviour, that can be really emotional as a practitioner to sort of think about that child being hurt. But I still have to think about, how is my face or my body language letting that child see that I still value them, that I see that behaviour as something separate to them? It's something that they've done. They can't take it away. But actually, there's still lots of really, really good things that there are about them. So it's that, even if you're shocked, you've got to try and have, I suppose, I don't know, your game face on. You've got to be thinking, right, I'm at work now. I need to be there for that child in that room to allow them to feel supported.
Yeah, so I guess on the back of that, it's about having really sort of good quality, informal and formal supervision, where if you do have some sort of complex feelings about a child or young person,
Explore them
in a safe environment away from that child.
Yeah. I mean, some of the other thing is, it's almost like getting your patter down, because talking about sex is difficult, and then talking about harmful sexual behaviour is even more difficult. Mm. And then when you're sitting with someone who doesn't want to talk about it, and you're also worried because it's a child and you don't want to get it wrong and you don't want to damage them emotionally, having had a bit of practice, and we've probably been doing it long enough now that we do have some of those sort of phrases and ways of saying it. But when I first started, I remember almost practicing and saying to my colleague on my first few visits, "Well, how do you just say it to them?" And thinking about how those initial conversations would go, how would I approach it? And because I practiced it and I thought about it, it was still awkward those first few times I did it, but it got easier.
Yeah, but there's nothing worse, is there, than a child's going to pick up on your own discomfort and embarrassment. So it's so much better if you can come across that you're confident. And also, I think sometimes even when we're talking about difficult things, it's much better to kind of talk about it in a really natural and light way, rather than like you go all whispery and quiet because you're like, "Oh, this is so awkward," or you're very formal and matter of fact. Because I think actually it's about, we know that this happened, and explaining it, but in the same sort of tone of voice and the way that you would speak ordinarily. What about things like how you ask those questions? So we both use that kind of like, "I'm wondering if," like to reflect back to children, which is quite helpful if you think you can see something in their responses.
You need to be interested in children, don't you, to do this job? If you're not interested in them and interested in their lives and you're not curious, that's going to come across to them. So be curious, ask questions, show that you want to know them and you want to know about them. And that's whether it's about the harmful sexual behaviour or it's about their life in general. I think sometimes it's quite hard if there's been denial and we sort of think, well, they've denied it, therefore we can't do any work. But actually, there's lots you can still do because, you know, denial isn't a precursor to risk. It doesn't mean that they have to go on to display further behaviours. And we can use case studies or third-person scenarios. Ultimately, that child or young person is going to be drawing on what they think and feel to answer those questions.
Yeah.
But by making it third-person, it stops it being about, you did this, what did you do, how did you feel? It might be, how do you think James felt when James did this? Because you've given him a case scenario that's very similar to what they might have done.
Yeah.
And then you can draw on that and you can think about, well, if actually James was feeling quite angry, there's quite a chance your young person might have been feeling angry as well. And then you can explore why they think James might have been angry, or whoever, you know, the young person is.
And for some young people, that is as far as they can go. But I think, you know, denial is their safe space, isn't it? So they're not doing it to be difficult or badly behaved or not engage with you.
It's might like, have a lot to lose.
This is what, exactly, and this is how they feel safe. So I would quite often name it, if I met with kind of denial, my reflection back would be, I can see that you just don't quite feel safe enough to explore that with me just yet, and that's fine. And I would just leave it at that, but I'd name it for what I believe that it is.
And you can try different ways of then going back in, can't you? You can think, I'm going to go back to that topic again, but I'm going to take time to think about it and how I'm going to approach that.
Yeah.
Some of the other techniques you might want to use is things like scaling questions. And what I'd say is, you know, just because this is harmful sexual behaviour, don't forget all of the other skills that you've got from working with young people in different settings. So if you're working with a child who has issues around anger or theft or something else, that doesn't mean that those skills and strategies won't work. So if you use scaling questions, you know, say from a scale of 1 to 10, how does a child feel about a certain topic? Or 10 being the worst they've ever felt in their entire life and 1 being the best, and then get them to plot themselves on it. It's a starting point, but it's also a really good measure because you can then ask them the next week, how are you feeling about it now? Or at the end of a session, how are you feeling about it now? Especially when it's a topic that maybe you can see that they've become quite emotional during the session, you need to regulate them back for the end of the session.
Yeah.
Scaling questions are a really good way of measuring that.
Yeah. And I do something similar as well as scaling questions for kids that don't get on so well with numbers and ordering and things is sometimes I'll draw a circle and say, oh, if this is your head, and we'll always name how bad I am at drawing to try and redress the balance of power a little bit. But anyway, do ahead and go, can you colour in like how big that feeling was in your head, or how much of your head was telling you to do this and how much of it was telling you to do something else? So it gives them that kind of visual tool as well, and you can see that sort of scale.
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. The second episode, which will be released next week, will look at specific sessions of direct work that you can do with children and young people, and this includes more general work and doing work around sexual behaviour and harmful sexual behaviour.
Thanks for listening to this NSPCC Learning podcast. At the time of recording, this episode's content was up to date, but the world of safeguarding and child protection is ever changing. So, if you're looking for the most current safeguarding and child protection training, information or resources, please visit our website for professionals at nspcc.org.uk/learning.